Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Before I introduce my guest, Marjorie Cohn, to discuss the latest book, her latest book, which she edited and contributed to, and I'll tell you about that in a moment, I just want to mention briefly what will be discussed in much more detail on Sunday with my guest then, who's Frank Barat. Frank is a organizing committee member of the Russell Tribunal in Palestine. And what's been going on has certainly attracted my attention in the recent days, writing on issues in the Middle East. And it's really dramatic stuff, ranging from Al Jazeera releasing the Palestine papers, the new government in Lebanon, Hezbollah-led, a nightmare for Israel and Washington, not because Hezbollah threatens anybody, because they just don't like Hezbollah. They like people they can control better, and they can't control Hezbollah anyway. There are protests erupting all across the Middle East, from Algeria to today the headlines in Yemen, besides what's going on in Egypt, in Jordan, and who knows where else, in Tunisia, with the prime minister, the president, well, let's call him what he is, a 23-year-old despot no longer. He's gone. Now off to Saudi Arabia. This is big stuff. It certainly has Washington's attention, and it has my attention, too. I've written a number of articles on this, and I keep following it, and I'm sure I'm not done writing about it. But we'll talk about that on Sunday. Today, it's Marjorie and Marjorie Cohn and her new book. Marjorie, well, let me tell you about her for listeners who aren't familiar with her. She is a law professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego. She's a past president of the National Lawyers Guild. She's also been a criminal defense attorney, trial and appellate levels, a noted author. She's also written many, many articles for popular websites, professional journals, and a number of books. One that Marjorie was on sometime back talking about, Cowboy Republic, and she certainly covered in that book what's covered in great detail in the new book, which is titled The United States of Torture. Indeed so, The United States of Torture. It has a number of wonderful contributors. Marjorie is one of them. Richard Falk is in it. Sister Diana Ortiz. A number of people I'm not so familiar with. But Marjorie, I welcome you to the program. I'm going to let you discuss the book and the important material in it.
Correct one thing. The title of the book is The United States and Torture.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
My typo.
No problem. The United States and Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse. And we have gathered here a historian, a political scientist, a sociologist, psychologist, philosopher, journalists, lawyers, to talk about different aspects of torture, the history and character of torture, the torture and cruel treatment of prisoners in U.S. custody, and then how to seek accountability for torture.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead and discuss some of the material in the book. And you've written a number of articles on this, and again in your book that certainly attracted me a couple of years ago, Cowboy Republic on the Bush Administration. You certainly covered it in that book, as well as Guantanamo and illegal wars of aggression and so on and so forth. But torture is a major issue, and you can correct me if you think I'm wrong, but I honestly believe that George Bush made it official policy.
Well, I don't think there's any question about that. John Yoo admitted that there was a common plan on interrogation, enhanced interrogation techniques, which is another word for torture and abuse. And during the Bush administration, lawyers in the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Counsel, including John Yoo and Jay Bybee, crafted memos that advised the executive about how it could torture and abuse detainees in their so-called global war on terror and avoid criminal liability under U.S. law. And these lawyers knew that their advice would be relied upon to interrogate detainees. And in fact, Donald Rumsfeld, Bush's Secretary of Defense, relied heavily on the torture memos in promulgating his list of aggressive interrogation procedures for use at Guantanamo, and they eventually migrated to Iraq. John Yoo and Jay Bybee and the other torture lawyers, the other legal mercenaries, didn't merely interpret the law in response to guidance about interrogation procedures. They argued it was legally permissible to torture and abuse detainees. And this is discussed in great detail in the book, and torture and inhuman treatment, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, violate three treaties the United States has ratified. And when the United States ratifies a treaty, it becomes part of U.S. law under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. The United States has ratified the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and the Geneva Conventions. The book starts out with historian Alfred McCoy, who talks about how the CIA, it's a historical look at how the CIA has refined the art of torture by developing techniques to manipulate human consciousness. Since drug research had been unsuccessful, the CIA explored sensory deprivation and stress positions to be used offensively by CIA interrogators and defensively to train U.S. troops to resist enemy interrogators. And then we move on to Bill Quigley, who is the legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and he talks about the School of the Americas, the U.S. Army School of the Americas, which has been renamed WINSEC, and how School of America's graduates from the United States, the graduates, people from Latin America mainly, but other countries as well, who attended this school in the United States, learned torture techniques and assassinated bishops, priests, labor leaders, women, children, community workers, and indeed massacred entire communities. And he talks about how 20,000 demonstrators descend upon Fort Benning, Georgia every year to demand that the United States government admit what it has done at this school and demand that the torture school be closed. We have a chapter by Stanford political scientist Terry Carl, who is an expert and testifies as an expert witness in cases involving torture committed in El Salvador when it was being supported by the U.S. government. She reports that thousands were tortured and murdered by the government and death squads of El Salvador while the U.S. was training, financing, and advising its army and intelligence establishment. And then she talks about how the United States uses what she calls deniability to cover up state terror by its allies, refashioning them into freedom fighters in order to maintain the support of the American people. John Lango, who is a philosopher, has a very interesting chapter asking whether an extreme emergency can ever trump the absolute prohibition of torture. And I should say that the Convention Against Torture, which is part of U.S. law, says that no exceptional circumstances whatsoever, including a state of war, can ever be used as a justification for torture. So torture is never, ever allowed under our law. So John Lango asks whether an extreme emergency, say nuclear weapon or ticking time bomb scenario, you know, the 24 situation where A, we know who the terrorist is, B, he knows where the ticking time bomb is, and C, if we torture him, he'll tell us where it is and save millions of people. John Lango rejects that scenario as fantasy, and he declares that terrorism can never warrant terroristic torment. And then Richard Falk, you mentioned Richard Falk, he has a very provocative chapter. He explores the moral equivalence of torture and one-sided warfare. He critiques the liberal moral outrage at torture, but the uncritical acceptance of one-sided warfare, where countries, especially the United States, inflict horrific pain on primarily non-white people in other countries, but suffer no consequences. And he draws an analogy between the torture victim and the subjects of one-sided warfare, both under the total control of the perpetrator.
Well, you know, back at Nuremberg, Marjorie, the court declared the supreme international crime, of course, talking about illegal war of aggression. So as horrific as torture is, it takes second place to illegal wars of aggression. Maybe without those illegal wars, we'd have a lot less torture. Well, we absolutely would have a lot less torture. We wouldn't eliminate it. And, of course, torture goes back a long, long way. It didn't begin with George Bush or back when the CIA was formed in 1947. It long predated that. But the ways of doing it and the numbers, because the population is so much greater, the techniques have been refined. It's not here. I mean, I've written a fair amount about this myself. And it really is astonishing, the stuff that we do. And, of course, none of this ever gets in the U.S. media. It simply is a topic for discussion. They just slough over it. And when events like the pictures and the provocative stuff that went on at Abu Ghraib in Iraq came out, well, that you couldn't cover that up. It just made headline news for a short time. But they never really went into all the detail they should have, and they tried to get rid of that story as fast as they could. And, of course, it's all gone, forgotten. Nobody remembers it. And, I mean, this stuff literally goes on day after day after day, and either we do it directly or our proxies do it for us. So Central America, we trained them, and our proxies did it for us.
Right. Yes, you're right. I mean, torture in this country goes back at least to the 19th century. Slaves were often whipped and tortured in other ways, and the United States has frequently aided and abetted repressive regimes that have tortured and abused their people. And when you talked about illegal wars, top Bush officials put heavy pressure on Pentagon interrogators to get colleagues Sheikh Mohammed and Abu Zubaydah to reveal a link between Saddam Hussein and the 9/11 hijackers, in order to justify his war in Iraq, his illegal invasion of Iraq. And so the CIA waterboarded colleague Sheikh Mohammed 183 times and Abu Zubaydah 83 times. Waterboarding has long been considered torture. And in fact, the information that they got from Abu Zubaydah and colleague Sheikh Mohammed was practically worthless, because when you torture someone long enough, they're going to say anything to get the torture to stop, such as Al-Qaeda is targeting every single building in the world. Pretty worthless information.
Boy, it sure is.
Right. Another chapter by Jane Mayer of The New Yorker talks about the extraordinary rendition program, where a country sends a person to a third country where that person is then usually tortured. And she talks about Sheikh al-Libi, who was tortured into providing information the CIA knew to be false. And yet Colin Powell cited Alibi's falsehoods to the Security Council to bolster the case for Bush's war with Iraq. We also have a chapter by attorney Mark Falkoff, who's also a law professor, who represents a Guantanamo detainee, a Yemeni, Adnan Farhan Abdul Latif, who has been held at Guantanamo for several years, and he collected information, Mark Falkoff, from his litigation notebooks, military documents, and his clients' letters and poems. And the resulting chapter is a powerful narrative in Latif's own words. He writes, "This place is like a hideous ghost." And Mark Falkoff could see the scars on the wrists of Latif, who was one of the hunger strikers at Guantanamo. many of the men and boys at Guantanamo who have no hope at all of ever being released, and of course almost very, very few of them have ever been charged with any crime, and many of them admittedly by the United States are innocent, were picked up by the Northern Alliance, sold as bounty to the U.S. military for $3,000 or $5,000, brought to Guantanamo, and of course many of them have been released, although after spending many, many years locked up like animals. But Congress is playing, using it as a political football. Obama wants to close Guantanamo, and they will not fund that, and they will refuse to allow people to be released into the United States, even though they're innocent, and many of them have been cleared for release, but can't be sent to Yemen. Many of them are Yemeni because they could face torture there. But yet, this has turned into a political football.
Boy, it sure has. I've got to ask you one question. Are you familiar with the case of Ahmed Khalfan Jilani?
Yes. Yes, I am.
You know what just happened to him. Now, he was at Guantanamo, and I think he's entirely innocent. Who knows? 284 counts against him for supposedly being involved in 1998 attacks on U.S. embassies in East Africa. He actually got a civil trial, one of the few to get a civil trial, and he was held at Guantanamo. I guess he's still there. 283... he was acquitted on the most serious ones. The only thing he was convicted of was conspiracy, which to me means when they charge you with conspiracy, they don't have any evidence to charge you with anything else, so they call it conspiracy. That's my view, based on the way we do things. The judge, just a couple of days ago, gave him life in prison. Were you aware of that?
Yes, I am. He is the only Guantanamo detainee to be moved to the United States to face a federal court trial before Congress said basically that they have to go to military commissions with a reduced level of due process. He was not suspected of being the main plotter in these bombings, and he was convicted of one count, and there was a big outcry by many Republicans saying, oh my gosh, this just shows that the civil courts don't work. He was acquitted of all of those other charges, and in fact, as you said, he was sentenced to life in prison, but not just life in prison without possibility of parole, which means he'll never get out.
Yeah.
This is the longest sentence that anyone has received. And even people who have gone through the military commissions. There was an Afghan teenager, Mohammed Jawad, who was charged with attempted murder for throwing a grenade at an American vehicle in Kabul in 2002. And in 2008, a military judge suppressed incriminating statements after he was beaten and his family was threatened. The military commission charges were dropped, and he was sent home to Afghanistan. Omar Khadr, a Canadian citizen who was 15 when he was arrested, is serving the longest sentence after he pled guilty to murder, he'll serve no more than 8 years behind bars, less than half of what Mr. Gailani is going to receive. Salim Hamdan, Osama bin Laden's former driver, was sentenced to 5.5 years in 2008, but given credit for time served, 5 months later he was free. So here you have Mr. Gailani, who was admittedly acquitted of a number of charges, and a lot of the reason of that that he was acquitted was because the government couldn't present evidence that they had obtained under torture. So we really ought to blame the CIA for torturing him, but yet he was convicted of this one count of conspiracy, and he's serving the rest of his life behind bars. So
and he will go to the only federal supermax prison in Colorado, which means he'll probably be in solitary confinement, which means he will go stock raving mad, and life sentence without parole, it may not matter, Marjorie, because before his life would normally expire, it probably will under those conditions.
Well, that's interesting you raise that issue, Steve, because one of our chapters written by journalist Lance Tapley describes the torture of prisoners, especially those who suffer from mental illness, in the supermax prisons in the United States. And he talks about cell extractions, one of the most common forms of abuse, where the guard slams the inmate's head against the wall and drops him on the floor while he's handcuffed. The point man smashes his large body shield into the prisoner, knocks him down, jumps on him, maces him in the face, pushes him onto the bed, twists his arms behind his back, and handcuffs him. And then the guard carries the prisoner naked through the cell block, continuing to mace him, then binds him to a restraint chair and leaves him there for hours, naked, cold, and screaming. And one inmate's arm was broken during the cell extraction. And then Tapley talks about solitary confinement, which can result in hallucination, depression, and catatonia, and says that that is a form of torture. And to bring that home even more, Bradley Manning, who is the U.S. Army private accused of leaking the, sending the WikiLeaks, releasing the what turned out to be WikiLeaks revelations, has been held for 7 months in solitary confinement. He's there for 23 out of 24 hours every day. He can't even exercise inside his cell. He's constantly supervised and monitored. He's denied a pillow and sheets. And the United States has more solitary confinement, prolonged solitary confinement, than any other country in the Western world. And in fact, a doctor, Atul Gawande, who is quoted in Lance Tapley's chapter, says that he said on Democracy Now! That we have more than 50,000 people in long-term solitary confinement in our American prisons. And people can experience solitary confinement as even more damaging than physical torture. John McCain, who was in solitary confinement for 2.5 years in Vietnam, had his legs and arms broken during his imprisonment, but he describes the 2.5 years he spent in solitary confinement as being the most cruel component and the most terrifying aspect of when he went through. And so we have Amnesty International, who just wrote a letter to Defense Secretary Robert Gates objecting to the conditions of Bradley Manning's detention. And the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Juan Mendez, is formally investigating the conditions of Manning's detention. So,
Larry, I've written about the U.S. prison system a number of times. Going back, it was one of the first articles I ever wrote. I wrote about, my title was The U.S. Gulag Prison System, The Shame of the Nation. And I was not talking about what goes on overseas. I was talking about what goes on in the continental U.S. and, of course, the other two states. I mean, it's really horrific. And there is torture that goes on, whether prisoners are in solitary or they're not in solitary. It doesn't mean it's done to everybody, but you get into these max security prisons, and the prisoners are really treated horrifically. After I wrote that article, I got an email, I remember, from a man who spent a few years at San Quentin in your state of California, and I mean, I covered an awful lot of ground in my article, and he said, let me tell you something, I could tell you stories that you didn't cover in your article. I mean, I'll make your hair curl. And he just mentioned a couple of things, and he went in there for minor stuff. He only spent about 3 years there. So I forget what the charge was, but it was minor, and he got out, and he saw plenty, and he didn't go into any detail of what happened to him, but he just wanted to let me know that you do not want to end up in San Quentin.
Right. Well, John Burge, who was the former Chicago police lieutenant, who tortured African-American subjects, suspects, shocking them, burning them, suffocating them. He ordered the torture by white policemen. He could not be brought up on torture charges because the statute of limitations had run due to a cover-up by Chicago prosecutors. But he was convicted of perjury and obstruction of justice for lying about the torture, and he was just sentenced to 4.5 years. There's another thing I think that we should mention here that's mentioned in the book, and that is that there's a connection between torture techniques used in the United States prisons and torture techniques used in other countries. hooded, robed figures with electrical wiring attached to them have been seen at the city jail in Sacramento, California. Male prisoners in Maricopa County jails in Phoenix were forced to wear women's underwear, and guards in the Utah prison system piled naked bodies in grotesque and uncomfortable positions. And the connection is more direct. John Armstrong ran Connecticut's Department of Corrections before he was sent to Iraq as a prison advisor. And on his Connecticut watch, two mentally ill prisoners died while being restrained by guards. Two more inmates died in custody after guards mistreated him. And Armstrong once made a remark that equated the death penalty with euthanasia. So we have a connection. People say, well, yes, there's this horrible thing, these horrible things that go on in other countries, but it doesn't happen in this country. I want to say a couple of words about the Obama administration. Manfred Nowak, who is the immediate former UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, said that to his knowledge, torture practices under the Bush administration are not continuing anymore under the Obama administration. He said he's not receiving allegations. He received them during the Bush administration on more or less a daily basis. But he did criticize the Obama administration for not pursuing the allegations of torture in the Bush administration. There is an obligation under the Convention Against Torture to independently investigate every allegation of torture or suspicion of torture. And he also complained that Obama, like Bush, has invoked the state secrets laws to block civil litigation by victims of rendition and torture. Let me finish. In October, the Bureau of Investigative Journalism reported that the Obama administration handed over thousands of detainees to the Iraqi authorities despite not knowing that there were hundreds of reports of alleged torture in Iraqi government facilities. And the United States' own troops had informed their commanders of more than 1,300 claims of torture by Iraqi security forces between 2005 and 2009. And yet in July 2010, the Obama administration completed the handover of 9,250 detainees to the Iraqi authorities. And again, Professor Nowak told the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, if the United States forces handed over detainees to Iraqi jurisdiction despite the fact that they were at serious risk of being subjected to torture, that is a violation of the Convention Against Torture. And the accounts include detainees being whipped with cables, chains, wire, and pistols, being burnt with acid and cigarettes, having electric shocks to their genitals, fingernails ripped out, fingers cut off, being sodomized with bottles, hoses, and raped. So we have the Obama administration saying we're not going to torture, and yet handing over, in violation of our law, handing over people to the Iraqis who are torturing them, and also the Obama administration violating our obligations under both the Convention Against Torture and the Geneva Conventions to investigate and prosecute all allegations of torture and cruel treatment.
Oh, Marjorie, I wrote about the torture going on in Iraq, and it's pretty horrific with case study examples of people who got out of the prison and told explicitly what was done to them. I mean, really, really horrible stuff. And I have to say, as long as there are places like Guantanamo and Bagram operating, Bagram in Afghanistan, They certainly aren't there just to incarcerate people. I believe torture is going on in these places every single day. So despite what the UN representative says, I don't know firsthand, but I honestly have to believe it's still going on.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that we need to be vigilant. I mean, one of the most disturbing things about the Obama administration is Obama's maintaining that he can hold people indefinitely without charges, and that's in response to not being able to close Guantanamo. Of course, if he did close Guantanamo, if Congress did allow it, then he would send them to another prison, perhaps a supermax prison, where they would likely be treated not well either. I just want to urge people to read, especially Sister Diana Ortiz's preface to the book, who describes the torture she suffered in Guatemala at the hands of Guatemalan and U.S. authorities when the U.S. was supporting the dictatorship. And she is very prominent. She's founded the Torture Abolition and Survivor Support Coalition International. She's a national symbol of the struggle to abolish torture.
Madhu, my great dad, we covered a lot of ground in 30 minutes. I thank you so very, very much. We crammed in the 30 minutes what we might have taken a whole hour to describe. You did a marvelous job, and the book is very important. The United States and Torture. I corrected it on my blog site, so it is stated correctly there. Madhuri, many, many thanks. Hurry up and write another book so I can get you back, but I hope I can get you back before that.
Thanks so much, Steve. Keep up your great work.
Thank you, Madhuri. And join us this weekend. Sunday, of course, we'll talk about events in the Middle East, including the Palestine Papers. And Jack Rasmus will be on Saturday to review what is going on in the economy. And it is not good. Unless you're a Wall Street banker, of course. Join us then.